So welcome back. So we've been looking at the birth of Jesus through the lens of the Gospel of Matthew this Advent. And this is a little bit of a challenge to pick songs and to tell because so much of our understanding of Christmas and our traditions are a mashup of Luke, of Matthew, of 2,000 years of tradition. And so even just trying to find songs that focus on one story or another are hard. A lot of the hymns and Christmas carols kind of put them all together, which is fine. But the challenge is when we're looking at, well, what did Matthew, how did he want to present the birth of Jesus, the Messiah, that we just kind of need to filter out some of these other traditions and things and see, like, what is the real point of his message? And so that's what we want to do this morning. And so last week we saw another very much of a mashup with the kids program. I looked everywhere this last week and I never found a Larry the used camel salesman in the scriptures. Now, one of the things that you see with Matthew and Luke, one of the differences is that Matthew presents the birth of Jesus more as a royal birth, told sort of through the perspective of Joseph. So we kind of get a sense of what Joseph was thinking when Mary became pregnant, why Luke tends to focus more through the women's perspective, through Mary's perspective. Now, one of the biggest changes when you come to Matthew is when we hit chapter 2. And then we have the Magi, and all of our nativity scenes are wrong. Okay, most of us, if we have a nativity, who here has a nativity scene? Okay, let's fess up, right? I think we have one. I'm not sure. We used to have a little Playmobil one, too, or something that the kids would use. And we would always think it's always the shepherds and the cow and the ox, all that is there together with the Magi, right? With the kings. They're all together looking at the baby Jesus. Now, one of the biggest differences when we come to Matthew is that the age of Jesus at this point in the story is probably more like this. Come on up. I have a live prop, maybe, that might work. Do you see yourself up there? Oscar. So this is baby Jesus. Come on up, Oscar. There. I have a gift for you. There you go. So this is sort of the age. Whoa! He didn't need it. This is the age that Jesus probably would have been in this story, like around 2 years old or so. So not a baby. And so I'm sorry for shattering all your images. Thanks a lot. It worked. We weren't sure if it worked. After last week, we weren't sure if it was going to work. but, you know, I hate to shatter all your images of baby Jesus surrounded by everyone with the star and everything. But when we come to chapter 2, that Jesus is in a house with his parents, and he's probably around 2 years old. So this morning we're going to take a look at chapter 2, but we're only going to look at the first part of the chapter. It kind of goes dark. It kind of goes sideways from verse 13 on. We'll look at that after Christmas. I was sort of told by the rest of the staff that we can't talk about that before Christmas. So we'll continue the story next week. So in the first verse of chapter 12, it reads, "In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem." So there's a number of things here. The first thing that we notice is that it's talking about Herod, Herod the Great, or really Herod the not so great. This guy was crazy. Okay, he was a brutal and paranoid ethnarch, which he was a king of a people within the larger Roman Empire. He was a client king. He was a puppet put in place by the Romans. And he wasn't even fully Jewish, right? So there's lots of reasons not that the people wouldn't like him, but probably the biggest reason why they didn't like him is that he liked to murder people. He liked to kill people. He was known for his brutality and his atrocities. At times over his reign, he executed half of the Jewish ruling council. He killed 30 court officers just because he wanted to. He executed his own wife, his mother-in-law, and three of his sons. So he was a man of ruthless cruelty and was fanatically paranoid. And that sort of is a backdrop to this story. And it really doesn't bode well for where the story is going to go, that you'll find out next week. Now, an interesting note that we get from Matthew 2 is that Herod's reign, he died around 4 BC, and so all of our calendars are wrong as well, right? Jesus would have been born probably around 6 BC, and we can blame this fellow Dionysus, who lived around 470 to 544. He kind of miscalculated a few things, and that's why all of our calendars, you know, because when they designed it, it was supposed to start, zero was supposed to be, you know, the birth of Jesus, and then go from there, but they're off a few years. So it continues and talks about the Magi from the east, and literally it's from the rising of the sun. And here, it's talking about the exotic Far East, and you've had people who have tried to identify where the Magi were from. Some suggest that they came from Persia. That's probably the most popular interpretation, but maybe Babylon or even Arabia, or maybe that they all didn't come from the same place, but they came from different places. We really don't know, okay? The main point here for Matthew is that they're not Jewish, right? That they're outsiders. And we'll come back to that as well. So who were these Magi? That's really the biggest question. And how many were there? We're not sure, right? Traditionally, it's three, because why? Yeah, I used to have three gifts up here, now I have two. So yeah, three gifts. But, you know, in some traditions, like in the Syrian tradition, there's 11 of them. There's four. There's all these different traditions about the number of how many there were. How about their names? Do we know their names? No, we don't. But, again, there's lots of tradition about the names. Probably the most popular ones with the three is Balthasar, Melchior, and then Caspar or Gaspar. Something like that, that is sort of a major tradition. You know, and then even just the question is, what is a magus? A magi is a plural. Like, what are they, right? Are they kings? Are they magicians? Are they sorcerers? Are they astrologers? Now, one of the most sort of authoritative New Testament Greek lexicons defines them this way. They say that they're Persian or Babylonian wise men and priest, who was an expert in astrology, interpretation of dreams, and various other occult arts. And again, the word there that to probably to think about is the idea that they're occult, that these are sketchy characters. They're not nice, kosher, Jewish characters, but they're outsiders who somehow God had revealed to them through the stars, through the sign in the heavens, and that they came and they worshiped the newborn, well, look at that, I even fell into it, the newborn king, the infant, the toddler Jesus. And so this is one of the earliest visual representations. It's the replica of a sarcophagus, a coffin from the 3rd century from the catacombs of Rome. And there it talks about, you know, the inscription on it reads, Severa, may you live in God. And so that's been probably there. That's a picture of Severa who is buried there. Generally, when you talk about the Magi in other references in Scripture, it's a negative characterization, that they're not individuals that you want to emulate. They are outsiders. They are, you know, like all the things with magic and occult, that this is what these associations come up with in scripture and in other literature at that time. So now the lack of detail in Matthew's account did absolutely nothing to stop speculation about these magi. Probably the biggest tradition, the strongest tradition that arose, is that they were kings. And, you know, we sang the song, right? We three kings. Well, they weren't kings, right? You have connections. You know, one of the reasons why this interpretation arose is that there was connections with magi in royal courts. Like in some Jewish traditions, the magicians of Pharaoh in Exodus during the plagues, that they are referred to as magi. And, of course, they're associated with the royal court. And so they're not kings themselves, but they're kind of advisors to the kings. That's how it's sort of used in Daniel chapter 2, verse 2 as well, where in the Greek text it actually does use the same word, magi. You have Philo, early, you can tell my voice is kind of sore, and I get to preach twice today. I'm preaching this afternoon virtually in Brazil, and so I will be popping the cough drops. So you have a lot of these connections with magi in the royal court. You have some intertextual connections that later people made the connection between the story in Matthew and Isaiah 49 or Psalm 72, where it talked about how when the Messiah came, that foreigners would bring presents to them. Now, Matthew and earlier scholars, you know, until the fourth century, didn't ever make that connection, but you have that connection that's made later. And then, interestingly, one of the first early church fathers, Augustine, in the fourth century, he did a series of sermons around Christmas time, and he used the Magi as examples of, you know, for the kings to bring their tithe to the church. Now, of course, this is after Christianity became legitimized and was the official religion. And so he used them as examples to sort of say, well, make sure to pay your tithes. And these foreign kings also, you need to give money to the church. Even though he never actually identified them, the Magi themselves, as kings. So early on, you have some of these hints that maybe there's more to them. And it really wasn't until the 6th century that you have this strong tradition where they are kings. And so this is a mosaic depicting three Persian kings. So they are dressed as how they understood Persian kings to look. And this is from the Basilica in Ravenna in northern Italy. And so this is around the 6th century that we have this. There's three of them. They're bringing three gifts. And if you look up top, they have names. So by the 6th century, you have Balthasar, Melchior, and then Gaspar, actually, in this tradition. And so early on, you have this strong tradition of them going. And then from there, you have even more detail given, where eventually they're from different continents, right? Where you have, in this image here, this is from the Swiss National Museum. So this is around 1400s, and it's from the Church of St. Peter and Paul. And here you have the three kings representing the continent of Africa, Asia, and Europe, right? So they're not all from the same place. And here, again, the idea is that that you have people from all over the world recognizing Jesus as the Messiah, as the King. But this is purely tradition. All the reformers like Luther and Calvin, they really had nothing to do with this identification. They saw it as a Catholic thing. And any modern scholar, virtually 100% of modern scholars of all different stripes would reject this identification, that it's a later tradition. And what I find interesting about this, and this is Mark Allen Powell, he has a whole book, a whole monograph on the Magi, Chasing the Eastern Star. And in this, he sort of, you know, highlights that one of the challenges with identifying them as kings is that it sort of changes the message of this, of Matthew, of the story. Because the point is, it's not that they're nobility or royalty that somehow is, as Powell says, that are supported by God, but rather the point of the story is that it shows God's preference, you know, to the powerless, to the fools, to the foolish Gentiles, right, who, you know, follow the star and come and worship the king. You know, while the people that knew the scripture, the religious leaders of Israel, the so-called king of the Jews, Herod, none of them recognized who Jesus really was. Now, another popular interpretation is that the Magi is wise men. Now, this is very popular. A lot of translations, we also, sometime during Advent, we sang about it too, the first Noel, where it talks, three wise men came from country far. And here, this is something that in a lot of translations, when they have the word Magi in the Greek text, they would translate it as wise men. So the King James, New Jerusalem, the New RSV, the New Living Translation, ESV, a lot of the popular translations. The NIV and the recently updated New RSV have Magi because they sort of don't necessarily want to identify them as typical wise men, because this interpretation became really popular during the Renaissance, during the Enlightenment, when reason was sort of exalted. Right, and the idea is, and you see Francis Bacon as one example early on in this time, where he saw the wise men as rational souls who used their knowledge to uncover divine truth. And so here they became very much identified as wise men because, through their knowledge of the stars, they were able to figure out, where Jesus or that the King of the Jews was born. And then notice how it's with the aid of scripture that they find out where. So even it's imperfect. But in this sense, at this time, the astrologers became astronomers, became more respectable. And again, I think that's not really the point of Matthew's story. There's not a single story or text that presents the Magi as wise or indicates that the knowledge that they possess, they did possess some knowledge, right, could ever be viewed as worthy of acquisition. So we're not supposed to read these stories and say, oh, I need to be more like the wise men and really look at the horoscopes in the newspaper. Because that led them to Jesus, while the scribes and the religious experts of Israel who studied the scriptures and knew the scriptures, they didn't find Jesus. Like, that isn't the point of the story. The point is that God revealed the star and the presence of Jesus to these Magi, and that they were outsiders. They were considered foolish. They were considered charlatans, but yet God had grace and mercy on them in that he revealed to them about the birth of the Messiah. So conclusions for this little deep dive into the Magi is that the point with the Magi, as they are first to recognize Jesus as King of the Jews, is that they are unexpected and unconventional outsiders to the people of God. And so one of the themes you see throughout the Gospel of Matthew is that Jesus came not just for Israel, not just for the people of God, but came for everyone, right? And at the end of the Gospel of Matthew, you have the Great Commission where we're to go into all the peoples of the world, to all the nations, and make disciples. And the other surprising thing with Matthew is that however unconventional the reference to the Magi are, Matthew presents them positively. Right? That they were receptive, that they were open, and that they recognized who Jesus was, and they responded appropriately with worship. So, anyways, now that we have the Magi all sorted, we can get back to the main part of the story. So they arrive in Jerusalem, and they inquire at the royal court. So the star takes them to Jerusalem, and then they inquire the royal court. So in verse 2 of the second chapter, where is the child who is being born king of the Jews? For we observed his star in the east. And so they go to the place where they figure that, okay, if someone knows where the next king of the Jews is going to be born, it should be people in the capital in Jerusalem. So they go there and they talk about this star that they observed. And this, again, is another thing. There's endless speculation about what this star was. Was it Halley's Comet? Was it some sort of supernova? Was it an alignment of the stars? Maybe, right? And there's you could do a deep dive on the interweb and be busy until Christmas Eve reading, actually even longer, reading all the speculation. But I think part of it here is that it doesn't seem to be an ordinary star, or at least the way Matthew presents it, it isn't ordinary. Because, you know, later on in verse 9, and the star they had seen when it rose, that now the star went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. And that's why, like, there's many traditions that also see the star as an angel. Right, that's, you know, an angel that specifically went over the house where Jesus was. I don't know. You know, but, you know, you read all this stuff, and I think that, again, part of this text is highlighting how God revealed to them, how God showed them and led the Magi to where Jesus was, you know, directly. Like, it didn't take a whole lot of calculations to follow this divine GPS. And they went right to the house where Jesus was, where the child was. The other thing that's interesting is that while the star directed them, ultimately, when they went to Jerusalem and they asked about the birth of this king of the Jews, is Herod called together all the experts and said, well, where is this Messiah supposed to be born? Which is kind of also showing with Herod that he wasn't very devout. Because if you were devout, you would know. When he called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. And the answer was Bethlehem. And that was very clear to all of them. They have this quote, so Matthew loosely quotes Micah 5 and adds in a phrase from 2 Samuel chapter 5, too. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means the least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. And so Bethlehem was the city of David, right? It's the city that David made safe, and that the expected Messiah, who would be of David's line and David's lineage, was expected to come from there. And even in John chapter 7, it was something that seemed to be common knowledge for the people, where it says, well, you know, does not Scripture say that the Messiah will come from David's descendants and from Bethlehem, the town where David lived? Like, it was kind of like, well, duh, everyone knows this. Well, except for Herod, because he's not the brightest tool in, sorry, the sharpest tool in the shed. There you go. So it goes on, and then you have Herod's plans. So he, you know, tells the Magi, he says to them, well, okay, you know, when exactly did you first notice this heavenly sign, this star? And then he sent them to Bethlehem, and he said, go search for this kid, this Messiah, this, you know, the king of the Jews, and then let me know so I can also come and worship him. It all sounded very pious. It all sounded very appropriate, but, you know, Herod, who was also known for murdering his own kids so he would still stay in power, he had no intent to worship the infant Jesus. But the Magi didn't really figure that out on their own, but they were warned in a dream to don't go back to Herod, but go home a different way. And then that leads to horrible and tragic consequences for the inhabitants of Bethlehem, but that's a sermon for next week. So when they do come to the house, so here you have these sketchy Magi, maybe there's a dozen of them. I'm just trying to resist that there's three. So coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and they worshiped him. And they presented him with their treasures of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And these treasures that they gave them, there's also long tradition over the significance of each of them, right? And we know them, gold is something that's given to royalty, right? It's a precious, it's one of the most precious metals of that time. You have frankincense, which frankincense is something connected with the priesthood, that it's this white resinous gum that comes from a certain tree in Arabia. And that's why there was thought that, well, maybe the Magi came from Arabia because of the gifts they presented, right? But it's used for medicinal reasons, but it was also used for different things related to offerings and incense and things like that in the temple and related to the priesthood. And then, of course, myrrh. It's also this resinous gum of a particular bush, and it is associated with being a burial spice. And so Jesus' sacrifice. And so there's this rich interpretation of these three gifts, which maybe that's the point. Matthew doesn't explicitly spell it out. But I think the point that you're supposed to get is that they're extravagant gifts fit for the true King of the Jews. That they are, here you have these servants, these Magi, coming and bowing down and worshiping this toddler and recognizing him with these expensive gifts, that he is truly King of the Jews, not the pretender who's on the throne in Jerusalem. So when we think about Matthew 2 and these first 12 verses, I would say that the main point for Matthew is that the Magi were Gentiles, right? They weren't Jewish. And they were the first to recognize Jesus as King of the Jews. That when you think of it, that Jesus came and he had all the wealth of scriptures and the prophets that pointed to the coming of the Messiah. But the scribes, or most of the scribes and the Pharisees and the religious leaders of the day, and especially not the political powers of the day, they did not recognize him as such. But instead, you have these sketchy foreigners who were considered foolish charlatans, but they recognized who Jesus was. And a secondary point is that God revealed the truth about the Messiah to these sketchy individuals. While those who were wise enough to figure it out for themselves and had all the resources and scriptures to be able to figure it out, they didn't. And so in this way, you know, Matthew is highlighting that the gospel is for all people. But all people who are humble, all people who are open to God doing the unexpected. Because all throughout Matthew's account, you find these unexpected elements of the story that show that that Jesus came for all, but not all recognized who he truly was. But those who were open and those who were willing to humble themselves and to recognize that this infant earlier on in Matthew, this toddler in chapter 2, was the rightful king of the Jews. And so the invitation this morning is like the Magi. Let's be like the Magi. Not in the Augustinian sense of let's give more money, but let's be like the Magi who are invited to come and worship Jesus. To humble ourselves, to realize that this is something that is, it's an epiphany, right? That's what this story is celebrated in the Christian calendar during Epiphany on January 6th, because it's something that God reveals to the Magi and by extension to the Gentiles. And so I invite you, like the Magi, to come and worship Jesus. And instead of bringing gifts, and you can still bring gifts, but the most important thing is a gift that we are given, the grace that we are given in Jesus, because he came, was born in humble circumstances, was recognized by the sketchy characters as a toddler. And as we see, he ministered throughout the rest of the Gospel of Matthew. He ministered, he healed the sick, he exorcised demons, he taught. But eventually, the ruling authorities rejected him, and he died on the cross. Not for anything he had done, but for what really we all have done. And he died for us. And then he was raised to new life. And so that's the biggest gift that we can accept, is that this king came to be worshipped. And the way that we worship him is to submit and to receive this great gift that he's given. And with all of the busyness of this season, with all of the turkeys and all of the ham and all of the, I was going to mention whatever the youth ate last night, the Kuchen, some German meal. All of that is to remember this gift and to follow the lead of the Magi. And let's worship Jesus together. And with that, I invite the